Advertising your business with GCN is simple, effective,
and more affordable than you might think.
Visit advertise.gcnlive.com for more info. Take your business to the next level.
The gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
When we first booked Greg Gigian on the Paracast, I was looking at his credentials and mentioned that, I'm quoting him, "I think it's important to chat about the development of saucer clubs and UFO organizations over the course of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And Greg, you've been talking about me, I think."
How's that?
I was originally a reader of a magazine called Flying Saucers by Ray Palmer. Do you know who Ray Palmer was?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I met him once, by the way.
Oh,
and
really? Indeed.
Yes. I can tell you stories. So anyway, there was a section in Flying Saucers magazine called Saucer Club News, which was kind of like a social network, maybe an early precursor to Facebook. And you would put information about your saucer club. If you didn't have a saucer club, you'd form one. Most of my friends for the next 50 years or so came out of Saucer Club News, like Jerry Clark and Alan Greenfield and Rick Hilberg and others. Came from Saucer Club News, came from Ray Palmer. So that's number one. Number two, as I mentioned, I had interviewed him once, Palmer, and he's quite a character. In fact, before we got started on the show, I'm reading a book, Greg, which maybe you were heard about, called The Man from Mars.
Yep.
From Fred Nardis. Except he doesn't quote me at all in the book. And I had a magazine where I not only ran the interview with Palmer and also arranged to interview him on a couple of radio shows, but I also had regular stuff from Richard Shaver.
Mm-hmm.
And I met and interviewed Richard Shaver, but he didn't quote me. But I like the book anyway. Let me ask you something here. You're a professor of history, Greg, as we proceed with your credentials. How did you decide to look into the paranormal with the Flying Saucer mystery being part of it?
Yeah, so it's kind of two intersecting kind of pathways, right? One's a kind of a longer one. One was a sort of a more immediate thing. The more immediate story is that I was at a conference, professional conference, with a colleague of mine. Her name is Monica Black, who was working on and finished, the book is out now, was studying this kind of renaissance in supernatural, paranormal interest and mystical phenomenon right after World War II in Germany that I had never heard of. I did not know that right after the war ended, like for a good decade or more, one of the things that was going on is that apparently Germans were utterly fascinated with the paranormal. And I had not known this. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. So after she gave a talk, I said, you know, I've always wondered whether the whole UFO thing had an impact over there at that time. Have you come across that? She said, no, I haven't. She said, you know, we're working with a colleague on a book, you know, and if you wanted to write up an article on that, we'd definitely be interested. And I'm like, yeah, I'm working on others. I don't think so. But it was planted in my head. And I was like, you know, let me. And so I just started futzing around. I started going into some databases that I had access to because I know German. And I went in and looked at newspapers from the time. And sure enough, there was all this stuff about flying saucers already in the late 40s, early 50s. I'm like, well, let me look at this. And I started outlining my thoughts. And pretty soon I realized I was writing an article about it. But what triggered it for me, and this is the longer part of it, is like so many people, all of us who are interested in it, it just seems to me just virtually everybody I know who's ever been interested in this has the same or a similar story, which is I got interested in it when I was really young. I was just utterly fascinated with this stuff. I was a kind of a loner as a kid because I was sickly for a long period of time. I had a lot of time on my hands. I kind of always was a bit nerdy and really liked to sort of dive into books. And so because of that, I really had all this sort of time where I'd be alone. And one of the things I became really fascinated with was flying saucers and UFOs.
You're talking about me here, fellow traveler.
Is that right? I think it's a lot of us who are like this, right? A bunch of us are like this. And I just couldn't get enough. I read everything. I was an equal opportunity reader. I didn't care if it was way out there stuff, middle of the road, nuts and bolts stuff, Phil Klass stuff and debunkers, anything I could get my hands on, I just devoured. And I really couldn't, you know, stop thinking about it, mulling it over, thinking about it. And I to this day, I'm not kidding. I credit in large measure my sort of going into academia to that exposure to the whole ufology world. Like, it was a world where people were always interested and curious to know more and more and more. And that kind of has stayed with me ever since. It's the thing that fuels me as an academic is I'm just curious about things. I don't necessarily have an axe to grind. I'm just really curious. So what that sparked it. And then when from that point, to go back to the original story, then I was looking into it. And a friend of mine said, you know, you ought to write a book about this. I said, come on, you know, I can't write a book about this. There must be tons of historians who've written books on this. And then I looked and I realized, you know, there's no professors of history outside of David Jacobs that I know of who's ever written a full-length history of the UFO phenomenon. And people have done bits and pieces of it in articles and things, but historians, we kind of have neglected this topic. And that's when I said to myself, I'm going to dive in. So for me, this is a real sort of a delight in so many ways, because in so many ways I feel like I'm returning to my childhood. I'm it's so interesting to read and revisit things that I remember reading when I was younger. And now, of course, I see them not only with as somebody who's older, but I see them now with the eyes of a historian. And it's fascinating to me. I recall how I was, you know, I felt when I was reading certain things. And now I see them in a different light and understand them. So that's how I got into this. And that's what sort of in large measure drives me.
Greg, do you bring this to your students there, or is this a quiet pursuit?
Oh, no, not quiet at all. I bring this to my students. I always tell the students the first day of class, whatever the class is I'm teaching, I tell them about the research projects I'm working on. And I always bring up the book on the history of the UFO phenomenon. And there's lots and lots of like, oh, wow, kind of factor. And then I teach a course. I teach a course that I've been teaching now for several years called The History of Monsters, Aliens, and the Supernatural, in which I, you know, the UFO thing can only be a part of it because I kind of go from the ancient world to, yeah, UFOs. And so it only is part of it. But lots and lots of students in that class are students who come up to me from the first day and say, I'm in this for the UFOs. I'm less interested in monsters. I'm interested in UFOs. And so I talk about it a lot with them. And I will tell you, there's a lot of appetite for the topic.
That is good to hear. Last week we had a woman named Zelia Edgar on the Paracast. She's 25, going on 26.
Wow.
And she has an extraordinary background in the field. And if I did not know her age, because her voice is very rich, I would think she's a woman in her 30s or 40s, because she's been around the block. Let me ask you a question that we're going to have to let sit till the next segment, and that is, Greg Egigin, have you ever, ever seen a UFO or had any other kind of paranormal encounter? And we're not going to let you answer till the next segment, so give people a chance to digest the question. And you probably have a fixed answer already, but that's how it goes. Greg Egigin is a professor of history who's studying, amongst other things, the paranormal. Our guest co-host is Kurt Collins. I'm Gene Steinberger in the Paracast. Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
If you're like most Americans, you're pretty much in disbelief with what's going on in the world. As we all know, global problems are having local consequences. Too many of them. And if the peanut butter really hits the fan, are you ready? Grocery store supply chains are only as strong as their weakest link. Don't wait for them to break. Now's the time to secure emergency food for everyone in your family. My Patriot Supply is America's largest preparedness company. Our specially packaged and delicious food stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. It'll be there when you need it. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and pick up several emergency food kits. There are a dozen different sizes that average over 2,000 calories per day. Our food kits will ship quickly and discreetly to your door. Having food storage in your home beats government food lines hands down. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com today and prepare for what's coming. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Do the letters IRS give you anxiety? I'm Dan Pilla. I've defended people from the IRS for more than 40 years. My book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, created the tax resolution industry and is responsible for helping hundreds of thousands of people. It can help you too. If you're a non-filer or facing IRS enforcement right now, your case is unique. You need real help, not cookie cutter advice. My clients get my personal attention. Buy my book at danpilla.com and get a free consultation directly with me. That's danpilla.com. Let's start solving your tax problem right now.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy, formerly Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, Air National Guard and Reservist. I'm looking for veterans, active duty military personnel to join the 90 for Life crusade to save America. She needs your skills, courage, and loyalty more than ever. Contact GCNteam.com. Because of the financial and healthcare collapse, veterans are currently struggling finding jobs. Frustrated looking for a job? Change your tactics. Join the 90 for Life crusade to save America. Start a healthcare business with FDI Longevity 90 for Life crusade. Contact GCNteam.com. Immediately. We're looking for military specialists who can use a computer and communicate information and execute a battle plan. Join the admirals, Navy SEALs, Marines, pilots, Army officers, military police, sheriffs, police officers, firemen, and first responders already enrolled in the 90 for Life crusade. Contact GCNteam.com now. FDI Longevity will help you apply your military skills to the task of saving America through health and financial programs. Contact GCNteam.com. Enlist in GCNteam.com and save America.
No matter how large or small your digging project may be, no matter how urban or rural, you must always call 811 before any digging project. 811 is our national one-call number, alerting your local utility companies to come out and mark any lines they have near your dig site. So before you do this or this, make sure you do this. For digging projects big or small, make the call to 811, brought to you by Common Ground Alliance.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
Okay, Greg, in response to my question, and I don't know if you've ever revealed this or whether anything's happened, anything strange ever happened to you?
Disappointingly not. In many ways, I really, really wish they had. I mean, I've seen, anomalous things. in the sky sometimes where I've had to look a long time to figure out is, you know, what is that? That is an odd thing. It's an odd shape or something like that. And then usually when I looked long enough, I'd realize I'd been looking at the reflection of light against an airplane or something like that. But I have never had any kind of, you know, sort of anomalous paranormal experiences, despite the fact that I'm absolutely fascinated with them. So it's a great disappointment in many ways.
Do you talk to lots of people who have had those encounters?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, part of what I want to do, and again, this to me is part of what I think you're obligated to do as a historian, at least the way I understand what I do. And that is, my job is to try my best to understand and appreciate and acknowledge the kinds of ways in which people experience reality and also talk about their reality. And to afford that a goodly measure of respect, but also understanding. I can't always put myself completely in somebody else's shoes, right? And we never can, maybe, completely. But I find it, and I consider it my job, is to make sense of it and understand it as best I can on the terms in which people understand it. And that helps me to, I feel like, better make sense of and analyze kind of the whole dynamics about this phenomenon as a social phenomenon. And in that sense, I kind of almost live vicariously through others.
Let's go back to that section we started the show with, Greg, the Flying Saucer Clubs. Now, yeah. You know who I am. And yeah. I'll just tell you my story very quickly. My story is, I was 11 years old. My mom and I visited my late brother, Wally, and his first wife, Rose. They lived in an apartment, one-bedroom apartment, on Carroll Street in Brooklyn. Don't even know if the building's up anymore. We're talking about a lot of years. And on his coffee table, he hadn't come home from work yet, but on his coffee table was a book called Flying Saucers from Outer Space by Major Donald Kehoe. And I looked at the book, and something caught my attention. I started reading it because my mom was talking with Wally's wife, and they were engaged in chit-chat, and I wasn't interested. So I looked at the book. I started reading the book, and after maybe half an hour or so, I went up to Rose, and I said, can I borrow this book? Because Wally finished with it. And she said, yes, you can borrow it, but you have to return it to the library when it's done. It was a library book. I said, okay. I did return it, by the way, folks. Not that I returned all the books I had, but seriously speaking, I did return that book, I promise you. I have no idea to this day why Wally borrowed that book, why he put it on the coffee table in a place where I could see it if I was there. He never evinced any interest in flying saucers, ever. Mm-hmm. At all. It's almost like he left it for me, figuring that because I like monsters and science fiction, I dig this. And I did dig it. And I started reading more and more books, kind of like you. I was a bookworm. I was the quiet, overweight bookworm. In fact, I didn't lose the extra weight till I was 18 and kept it off. But I was the quiet guy, and I read this, all these books. Eventually, I met a lot of the people that I read books about. As I said, people like Ray Palmer, people like Richard Shaver. I got involved in the Flying Saucer Club specifically to meet fellow travelers. What did you learn at all in looking at the saucer clubs? Anything interesting about them you can tell us?
Well, the first thing is it was to realize that the saucer clubs in so many ways, and Palmer's a great example of this, right? Because they in a sense, they took their cues from the early science fiction clubs, right? And that's where Palmer was cutting his teeth, right? When all this starts to unfold. And he himself, right, had been involved in these kinds of science fiction, I guess we call them now, right, fanzines, right? And all that stuff, and had helped to build some of the these early ideas of a club, right? That to me was fascinating, that the Flying Saucer Clubs were not really the first to do this. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting is like a kind of a sociological phenomenon is the way in which the saucer club becomes something really distinctive and really, really unique. I mean, you know, you see this already with one of the first somewhat larger organizations, the LA organization, what is it, Civilian Saucer Investigation, CSI, right?
Civilian Saucer Intelligence of New York.
Intelligence, right. What is that? It's nine, already, in, is it 51 or 52? They're already operating or starting to develop. But what's fascinating is that what's slightly different about the flying saucer clubs and where they end up going, say in comparison to this sort of like, you know, fandom groups that were almost the equivalent of book clubs before, is that of course these, many of them morph into just that, investigative organizations, right? And I don't know if that was the case with you when you got involved, was, you know, that there are people who said, well, we could sit around and read and talk about all these stuff, all these things, but what about if we take it upon ourselves to actually dive in and do our own research? And that, to me, that switch, that turn, that's what makes them different. Something really distinctive and really important, because in the end, I think there's going to be many reasons why this UFO thing as a social phenomenon, you know, has the stability and the resilience that it does over the decades. But one of the things that's going to fuel it is it just that very thing. It's going to keep it alive is the passion, not just the passion of people, but the dedication to doing the hard work, the activity of actually investigating things. That's one of the things that makes it, I think, a really, really distinctive thing as a kind of organizational social movement.
I really miss the loss of their newsletter. We had Ted Blosher, Lex Mebane, Isabel Davis. I knew
great
them slightly.
People. Fascinating. I love reading their stuff.
It was just very well written, well researched. They didn't have the wild-eyed viewpoint of the phenomenon that some people did. They looked at it as a scientific mystery. Their articles were well written, and I don't think many other publications since then have been as good. The problem, of course, is, like everything else, there was not enough money or incentive to keep it going. But it started in the 50s, as you say, and I guess ended up in the 60s, before we had MUFON, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
I think if you compare their publication with MUFON, it was a hell of a sight better. Greg Agigian joins us, professor of history, who we're looking into the world of the unknown with an emphasis on UFOs, with Gene and Greg. And Kurt, you're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.
What if you could cut your heating bills this winter with your existing wood-burning fireplace and not spend thousands doing it? You can with Great Wall of Fire fireplace grates. Our U.S.-patented, made-in-America Wall of Fire grates increase fireplace efficiency, eliminate fireplace smoke problems, and come with a 30-day money-back guarantee. See our grates in action and get free shipping from walloffire.com or call 800-274-7364. Fireplace heat without fireplace smoke. Walloffire.com.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Crime is up in big cities across the nation, including New York City. And Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg is going back on what many criticized as soft-on-crime policies, vowing to now prosecute lawbreakers. Fraternal Order of Police National Vice President Joe Grimaldi joins Fox News and is calling for a stronger response to hold criminals accountable.
We need to vehemently prosecute violent criminals, we need to restore the rule of law, and we need to embrace broken windows theories, and along with supporting and funding our police departments, we can accomplish that goal.
A 5-year-old boy who had been trapped 35 yards underground in a well in Morocco for 4 days was found dead following a lengthy rescue attempt. You're listening to USA Radio News. A campaign is continuing to educate women about their heart attack risk.
Friday was National Wear Red Day, part of the American Heart Association's ongoing campaign to remind women that they are not just at higher risk than men for heart attacks, but in fact, heart attacks are the number one cause of death in women. Dr. Noelle Berry-Mers of Cedars-Sinai Hospital telling CBS News,
"We are doing this because of the rising cardiovascular death rates in women, particularly younger women under the age of 50. And particularly women of color. And this started before the pandemic, but it has been exacerbated by the pandemic."
And she says that in many cases, women's stress levels directly relate to their heart attack risks, which is why it's often called broken heart syndrome. And for USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
2-time gold medal winner Shaun White is set to retire after the Beijing Olympics. You're listening to USA Radio News.
February is Heart Month. Every year for the month of February, to show our appreciation to Extendivite's faithful customers, we have a sale. If you would like to try Extendivite, now is the time to get a few months ahead and really give Extendivite the time to show you how it works. Most of Extendivite's long-term customers wait for this sale to stock up. People and doctors tell us about the unbelievable improvements that they have experienced in their overall health, not just the heart. Extendivite wants you to experience the power of these herbs. Get a 4-month supply for only $115 for either the capsules or tincture. Please take advantage of this once-per-year sale and get healthy for life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or find us on Amazon.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
This is Big the Merciless. You are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio, exactly according to my plan.
Again, that was a really, really solid introduction. CSI of New York, not the TV, the lousy TV show on crime scene investigators with Gary Sinise. It was the original Flying Saucer Group, one of the best Flying Saucer clubs of its type. Greg, continue.
Yeah. So what was I going to say? One of the things I thought, too, that kind of strikes me about the kind of work that these organizations were doing was, and maybe this gets to the what you were just describing, because, you know, I think for those of us who you know, whatever it is in us that has a passion for reading all of these older articles and older books and things like that, is, and when we're struck with this idea that some of that stuff just seems so much maybe better written, maybe it's more ambitious, maybe there's a kind of vitality to it. I do think that part of that might be explained by the fact that when you look at, say, the first decade of the phenomenon following Arnold's sighting in 47, so, you know, up to around the mid-50s, that in many ways the whole phenomenon was still kind of up in the air, no pun intended, that in the sense that there was people were still very unclear on how to frame this stuff, how to think about it, how to talk about it, what vocabulary to use, right? It was all sort of open-ended, which I think when you look at in history at other moments in time when people are trying to understand new phenomenon, that period of open-endedness usually brings about a kind of a creativity, and it allows for, I think, a kind of a creativity and an innovativeness that can be a little more difficult when you look later on, you look decades later, and when, in fact, you know, you get down by the 1980s, a lot of the positions about UFOs have all been staked out, right? Everybody's put their flag down somewhere. And so I feel like in the 40s and 50s, it was a lot easier to sort of, you know, meander around. And in that came, I thought, something kind of creative.
So Greg, I had a question for you. You know, there's a lot of interwoven things here. One I wanted to ask you was the speaking from a cultural standpoint, what were some ancient events or activities that are similar to our fascination with UFOs today?
Yeah, there's quite a lot, right? So we know that dating back, yes, right back to ancient times, observers, people chronicled and talked about seeing kind of anomalous things in the heavens. And certainly, I think in retrospect, we tend to associate them now with being probably meteors and comets or odd meteorological events of one kind or another. There's no question that people looked up into the sky, saw things that they thought shouldn't be there or couldn't be there or couldn't explain in some ways. And these kinds of things were oftentimes framed in terms of being great wonders, great marvels of one kind or another. You have similar kinds of things being said too about kind of terrestrial events. You know, there's of course a long history and legacy of people talking about and chroniclers in the ancient medieval world talking about, you know, well, if you travel to these odd foreign lands, you'll see these strange people with, you know, heads on their bellies and seven arms and, you know, and all of these things. You have mariners who, of course, told stories of seeing strange lights or seeing ghostly ships, right, and things like this. So there has always been a lineage of a long litany of stories that have come down and been passed down generation after generation of people saying, you know, there's something odd, there's something strange, there's something that defies explanation, or at least defies my own explanation. And many of those get framed, as I say, as marvels. And the thing about marvels and wonders was that these are things that are seen as expressions of divinity, of the deity, of God, or the gods, if you're dealing with polytheistic universes. And that, to me, I see that as interesting and important, because later on, when you start to talk about the 19th century, and you start seeing, and people start talking about seeing strange airships, when you get into the 20th century and you start talking about UFOs, that sense of wonder, the sense of marvel, the sense that some sort of superhuman power must be behind these things. That never leaves, right? And that becomes, I think, folded into then these more modern stories that we get over time.
I'm glad you mentioned the airships, because that's kind of a bridge between the ancient and the modern. And forum member Richard Hawkins had a question for you about the airships. And we know they kind of had a there was a lot of public interest. I mean, it wasn't organized like UFOs today, but he says the part of his question in particular was that, you know, they were describing something technological that was ahead of what actually could be built, but, you know, they didn't know what it was and, you know, if it was from an inventor. So can you talk a little bit about that, the way they were perceived and discussed?
Yeah, so I've seen narratives and chronicles and testimony of claims of seeing these airships as early as the 1830s. But the, probably the most famous event of the 19th century, at least, was in 1896 and 1897, and this sort of wave of supposed sightings of airships that starts out in the West Coast, out in California, sort of tails off for a while and then reappears in early 1897 and then starts to play out in other parts of the United States. And what's kind of fascinating to me about the strange airship sightings is one is, first of all, what people describe tended to be and what gets reported on tend to be things that are associated with sort of developing technologies or at the very least technologies that people can imagine as coming down the pike at some point. And so typically the airships get described as having these lights, right? They may be at times talked about as being fueled by steam engines or something like that. Sometimes they actually look like actual, you know, the kinds of ships you would see on the sea. That's one of the things that's interesting. The other is you just mentioned, Kurt, was the idea that by and large, people believe the figures behind these airships were these kind of eccentric, inventive tinkerers, right? Who would come up with these devices. And in some cases, you actually have the press reporting that some guy coming forward or his lawyer coming forward and say, I'm the guy who's behind this. I'm the one who built it and I'm going to show you. Or if you give me this much money, I'll share it with you. These kinds of things.
Now, if you can't get enough of Greg Aghedian, and we can't, he'll also appear on this weekend's edition of After the Paracast, which is part of the Paracast Plus package. For more information, check out the Paracast.plus. Once again, that's the Paracast.plus. There you get the latest low prices, plus quick sign-up instructions. You can get yourself set up as a member of the Paracast Plus in, say, 30 seconds to a minute or so. Let's do our break with Greg and Gene and Kurt. You're in the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on the special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream. A dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
Has your body ever gone low blood sugar, feeling weak, shaky, knowing you better eat something fast? We all know high blood sugar can lead to many metabolic problems. At GCNteam.com, we have a healthy blood sugar pack, focusing on the structure and function of stable blood sugar. Find us at GCNteam.com or call 877-878-4203. Nothing feels worse than unstable blood sugar. Call 877-878-4203. That's 877-878-4203.
Silver has always been nature's very own antibiotic, and only one system allows you to generate an endless supply of natural silver solutions. SilverLungs.com. You'll find no wild claims or pseudoscience, just a lifetime of nano-sized pure silver solutions. The Silver Lungs generator allows you to make your own, so stop paying for silver solutions. The unique lung delivery system targets respiratory infections where other silver solutions simply cannot reach. See the Silver Lungs generator and lung delivery system at SilverLungs.com. That's SilverLungs.com.
Hey folks, Tom D for ParanormalDate.com.
Are you looking for love in all the wrong places? Now you have a chance to change that by signing up free at ParanormalDate.com. This incredible dating site puts people of like minds together. People who are interested in the strange, the unusual, ghosts, zombies, UFOs, crop circles, and more. ParanormalDate.com was developed for you, people who seek a little more than the other dating services offer. You can join for free by going to ParanormalDate.com, and if you decide you like it and you want to connect with others, use the code George for a substantial discount. So many people want to share their experiences with the paranormal, the afterlife, the unusual, and this is the place to meet and share common interests with those of like minds. So sign up for free at ParanormalDate.com. That's ParanormalDate.com. Use the code word George and start meeting others. Get going now and connect with someone you like.
We are GCN, the Genesis Communications Network. We've got listeners, lots of them. Around the world, around the clock, our listeners do what listeners do. They listen. And you know what listeners got? Needs. Needs for your products, your services, and money to buy those needs. With our network of over 1,000 radio stations, streaming on the web, and our satellite transmissions, we're reaching our listeners with quality conservative programming. But there's something our listeners don't have. Your offer to meet their needs. Any business needs buyers, but if our listeners don't hear your message, they're still going to buy what they need, just not from your business. So let's fix this. Tell us about your business. Then let our super creative department go to work to craft just the right message for our GCN listeners. Get started today with GCN, the Genesis Communications Network. Just shoot us an email. advertise@gcnlive.com.
Hi, this is Don Ecker, and you are tuned into the Paracast. Let me tell you what, you're going to hear stuff here that you probably won't hear anywhere else. Hear that, George Snorri?
Okay, so Greg Adigian is telling us about the history of the airship reports, especially in 1896 and 1897, all around that time. But before we go back to the conversation, some of these were published in newspapers, and there's a feeling that those stories were made up by the publisher or the editor to get higher circulation. So maybe you can address that before we go back to the claims.
Right. It's a serious line of questioning, right? The extent to which these things can be trusted, especially once this starts to develop a bit of a head of steam in the press, and the fact that all of these things get clustered around the same kinds of areas and regions, right? It does seem to be reasonable to suspect that at least in some, if not many of the cases, what you're dealing with is a kind of copycat phenomenon of the publishers, right? Keeping up with the Joneses, making sure you sell newspapers. A colleague of mine who has written on the history of newspapers in 19th century America, a good rule of thumb to know whether you should maybe trust an article from that period or not in terms of its reporting is to look for specificity. He said more specificity tends to lend it some measure of credence. If it tends to be vague, you may well suspect it was invented or concocted in some ways. There's no question that the artist renditions, and there's many of them, you can see them online when you Google, the artist renditions tended to be fairly fanciful. There's pretty good evidence to indicate that artist renditions of a lot of things in 19th century newspapers were really quite fictional and fanciful in that regard.
In other words, this was the real fake news. This is what fake news was about.
Not the fake news, but the real fake news. Yeah, absolutely. You know, to me, the thing, though, that's really interesting is, again, to see in the way this stuff was discussed and talked about is that, by and large, there's some exceptions, but by and large, this stuff wasn't associated with any kind of panic. It wasn't framed by the newspapers, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of it. I mean, there's some stories here and there that seem to talk about people being a little caught off guard or maybe a little panicky. But by and large, that sort of wave didn't seem to be associated with and tied into any kind of fear, mass fear. That's going to change like by around a decade later. There's another big wave that starts taking place, particularly overseas in England. In 1909, there's another one in 1912, there's another one in 1914. And when you look there, it's a really different story. There you have a set of a series of different waves of sightings that now seem to be, of course, folded into fears about German invasion. The German Navy was building up. By that time, Count Zeppelin had developed his Zeppelins, and there are people actively talking in the English press and in the English Parliament, by 1912 at least, if not farther back, talking about the fact that one of the things we've got to concern ourselves with is a Zeppelin attack with the next war. And so by that time and in that environment, the narrative is a very different narrative. These things are scary, they're sinister, and they seem to be a portent of something either that is happening right then and there or is soon to come, and we've got to worry about those nasty Germans across the channel.
I have a quick question, and Kurt will probably have others. Do you think, looking at all these reports from the 19th century, the early 20th century, there was any reality to any of them?
There doesn't seem to be, from what I can see. And in part, that is a reflection of what other sources from the time period are talking about. So there doesn't seem to be any evidence that, for instance, in 1909, dirigibles were going over areas in England and scouting things and were landing, or in 1912, you know, that the dirigibles financed by the German government were landing and Germans were getting out and sort of mapping or taking a look and doing surveillance. There doesn't seem to be any evidence of anything like that taking place. Now, did people maybe see something odd? That may well be. It's very hard to say, to my mind, on the basis of the source material we have. And certainly, I think when you talk about 1912 and especially 1914, the early days of the war, even the people who investigated these cases, like the police, like civilian government organizations, who went in to look into some of the claims that, for instance, there were claims in 1914 that people said, "Oh yeah, I happened upon an aerodrome where a bunch of Germans were holed up and had their Zeppelins there and were all armed." And, you know, the police went out there, never found anything, could never see anything that was there. So there seems to be good reason to suspect that a lot of this had to do with a lot of the panic, justified panic, mind you, but the panic that ordinary people had in light of the fact that war was coming.
Okay, well, this is sort of related to what Gene just asked. From a perspective of a historian, what UFO events? Well, I guess before I should give this some introduction. So most events throughout history have conflicting witness testimony, ambiguous details, and then, you know, you get to the UFO topic, and we've got that in spades. There's just so many uncertain details. But what UFO events could be looked at, you know, as a historical event, and what could you say about them?
Yeah, right. You're so right, Kurt. I will tell you, when I got into this, I knew it would be complicated. It would be challenging. I maybe underestimated how challenging it would be for exactly the reason you just talked about. So many conflicting perspectives on things. Oftentimes people, you know, making claims that are based on second, third, fourth, fifth hand rumor, people's testimony and testimonials about what happened changing over time, depending on the context. And oftentimes it's very difficult to know where actually a report or a story actually ever began. And that's one of the things I've been trying really, really hard to do when I go on and investigate a specific incident. I try to find out when and where did it begin. It can be oftentimes almost impossible to do. One of the things, for instance, I've looked at and I'm thinking of in this regard is something like the wave of sightings of 1973, right? 1973 brought about a considerable number of sightings and reports. In the United States, the core of it or the center of it seemed to have been the American Southeast, but it expands beyond that. Later on, people like Jacques Vallée will say that then later on in the year, as you get closer towards, I guess, November and December, the waves started to be experienced overseas in Europe, particularly in France. It's an interesting case because, to me, waves are a kind of a slippery term, right? What do we mean when we talk about a UFO wave? We know what people mean in ufology by it, right? These number of sightings over a relative lengthier period of time that covers a certain area that usually is more than just, say, one town or one rural area, right? It needs to be a little more expansive than that. And the 1973 wave is interesting because by then, right, the government has gotten out of looking and investigating UFOs. So where's the data coming from? Where do we know, come to find out about the wave? Well, this is where I approach it as an historian. I approach it by saying what I'm interested in is not the UFOs per se, because I don't know that I can say anything about them. What I can talk about are the UFO reports. And the UFO reports come from basically two sources. They come from local newspapers and they come from UFO organizations. And this is where the material is coming from. And so the people who are talking about a wave are these newspapers and magazines on one hand and UFO organizations and investigators on the other. The two seem to be lockstep in some measure, though they're going to be more skeptical newspapers here. So really the question then becomes, you know, how do we explain how this stuff gets framed and talked about as a wave? What is it that is fueling that, and who, if anybody, is playing a role in continuing to sort of talk about it in that fashion?
Let's for a break, sure, with Greg, Gene, and Kirk. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
You don't sit behind a desk every day to earn a living. You're out and about making it happen. And sometimes you get a little bit behind on your paperwork, you know, like bookkeeping and paying your taxes. It's easy to get behind on paying your taxes. It happens to the best of us. And you know what happens next. The big, bad IRS comes knocking on your door. And when that happens, you need to call the good old boys at the Tax Doctor. Let them do what they do best. Deal and negotiate with the IRS so you pay the lowest you can in back taxes that the law allows. We are a 100% U.S.-based company, and we've saved our clients millions over the years in back taxes. If you owe $10,000 or more in back taxes, call my friends right now at the Tax Doctor and learn more.
800-507-3137. 800-507-3137. 800-507-3137. That's 800-507-3137.